Super PAC money has come to the Philadelphia District Attorney's race. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A political committee funded by liberal billionaire George Soros is spending big bucks to support candidate Larry Krasner in next month's Democratic primary. Joining me now is WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. Dave, why does George Soros care about the district attorney's race in Philadelphia?
Well, Soros is among a lot of people across the country who are concerned about the heavy rates of incarceration in our criminal justice system. There's a feeling that for young African-American men in particular, too many are tainted early with the stigma of felony convictions and condemned to lives of poverty. So, you know, Soros and a lot of other people want to bring more justice and compassion to the system, and I guess they would say rational thinking. So Soros has put more than $6 million into supporting progressive DA candidates around the country. So now he has a committee here supporting Larry Krasner. He's a civil rights attorney favored by a lot of activist groups.
And do we know how much money he's devoting to this contest?
We do. And to give it some context, you know, Philadelphia has limits on political contributions, but because of court decisions like Citizens United, they can't limit independent spending. This new committee, which is called Philadelphia Justice and Public Safety, has bought about $280,000 worth of ad time. That's for just 1 week, starting tomorrow. And to put that buy into context, it's more than 10 times what a political committee could give Krasner or any other candidate under the city's contribution limits.
Sounds like it's enough to help swing the contest.
Well, it could. I mean, this is a curious race, Dave. You know, you have seven candidates in the Democratic primary, none particularly well known as the race began. And one thing TV ads can do is buy you name recognition. And if the Soros group keeps spending at this level until the election, which is 3 weeks away, that would be $840,000 worth of TV ads. Yes, it could make a difference. That's not the only factor. And he won't be the only candidate in the game, you know. Some of our listeners have probably already seen ads for Michael Untermeyer, a former Republican. He's put more than $500,000 of his own into the race. Others, including Joe Kahn, have the money to get into television. And just recently, Jack O'Neill, a new candidate, got a bunch of endorsements from building trades unions. They tend to be big givers, so he won't be the only candidate on the airwaves.
You know, I might imagine that Soros is among the cohort who hate the Citizens United decision. That's the one allowing big money in all kinds of races. So how do they feel about this?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And, you know, I think Democrats really hate when they see Republicans spending big money because this decision, after all, was passed with a majority of conservative justices on the court. And I think a lot of Democrats squirm even when people they agree with do it. One thing we can note is that Philadelphia has enacted laws to require a lot more thorough and frequent disclosure of outside spending in local races here than happens with federal law. So at least we'll be able to shine more light on this activity here than it gets in some places.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Dave.
WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies. Now, all of the candidates for DA say they're committed to police reform and accountability. But when it comes to the issue of examining whether officers misbehave by firing their weapon in the line of duty, change may be hard to come by, as WHYY's Bobby Allen explains.
Over the last decade, Philadelphia police officers have fired their weapons at people 435 times. Of those, the bullets killed 103 people. But the number of on-duty officers who have been charged by the DA's office? Zero.
Hard to believe that you got 430 shootings where every one of them was truly justified under the law. You know, that nowhere in there is a manslaughter or murder. But that's the norm.
Philip Stinson is a criminologist at Bowling Green University who has studied police shootings. He says the issue in Philly reflects a national one. Police are almost never charged. Stinson recently met with a group of top prosecutors in Atlanta to talk about this issue. And he says there's a consensus emerging among big city DAs that some police shootings must be unjustified, but there are little consequences. He says at many DA offices, district attorneys are
figuring out better ways to handle these cases to make sure that they're properly investigated, that their charges are brought when they're appropriate, and that that the politics of it all don't, you know, result in it just being swept under the rug.
Whoever becomes Philly's next DA will be confronted with many obstacles to holding police accountable for firing their weapons, figuring out a way to independently investigate police shootings, overcoming resistance from the politically powerful Fraternal Order of Police, and convincing grand juries to charge in cases of alleged criminal acts. Lawyer Tom Klein has represented those shot by police. He says policing the police should be a big priority for the city's next DA.
This is a public trust and a public confidence issue. There is a need for the public to feel safe, not only safe from criminals, but safe from police.
An official at the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office said in a statement, it does not turn a blind eye to criminal acts committed by a citizen or by police. Local prosecutors have charged 5 off-duty officers over the last 10 years, but never one who fired their weapon in the line of duty. Klein says the public should be outraged by that.
And every time one of these things are videotaped or seen or witnessed by credible witnesses, the public rallies to the same conclusion, which is it shouldn't happen. And that's because we all fundamentally understand that we don't want it to happen to us.
He says if prosecutors can't clear the bar to charge an officer, police bosses can fire those who engaged in misconduct. But as he has found, more often than not, officers are more likely reassigned than to be let go from the department. Officials at the FOP Lodge 5 never return calls seeking comment for this report. For WHYY News, I'm Bobby Allen.
Researchers at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia have created a device that could revolutionize care for extremely premature babies. The invention mimics the mother's womb and could allow these vulnerable infants to continue to develop as if they were still in utero. Joel Wolfram reports.
You can think of the device as a kind of artificial womb. The preemie goes inside a plastic bag filled with a substitute for amniotic fluid. Nutrients and oxygen are delivered through tubes connected to the umbilical cord.
So what it is it's really a device that replicates the environment of the womb and provides the function of the placenta. And that's how this system differs from previous attempts, in that we've actually been able to replicate the normal physiology of the fetus.
That's Alan Flake, one of the lead researchers on the project at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Advances in technology have allowed many babies delivered after only 22 to 23 weeks to survive. The problem is that most of these extreme preemies suffer permanent disabilities, such as cerebral palsy and lung disease.
Currently, there's no way to support these infants without those associated problems.
That's where the artificial womb comes in, allowing the preemie to continue developing just as it would have inside the mother. And the protected development could go on long enough for the baby to escape the worst problems. The CHOP researchers tested the device in premature lambs and found the animals developed normally in the artificial womb for up to 4 weeks. In human terms, that's enough time to get through the most high-risk period. The researchers are now working with the FDA on preliminary studies before trying out the device on premature human babies. They hope to be ready for a clinical trial at CHOP in 3 to 5 years' time. For WHYY, I'm Joel Wolfram.
It comes as little surprise that outcomes for criminal defendants are closely related to their ability to afford counsel. What may not be known is the extent to which indigent defendants are uniquely disadvantaged in Pennsylvania. Journalist Joe Chevalier focused on practices in Bucks and Montgomery counties. Her article, What Price Justice, appears in the Bucks County Courier-Times. Joe, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Tell us about how Pennsylvania is unique in this regard.
Well, Pennsylvania, as I learned, is the only state where county government shoulders the entire burden of funding and administering criminal legal defense services for the poor. It's also the only state that lacks any kind of a oversight or quality standards for indigent criminal justice representation. Essentially, all those funding decisions, the income guidelines that are used for qualifying for a public defender, are all left to county government.
How are those funding decisions more typically handled in other states?
In other states, it's handled at a state level, that there are minimum standards in place. I also understand that can also vary from state to state. So there's no national standard, but at least there's a state standard in place and that there is state funding towards criminal legal defense.
Now, were you able to evaluate all of Pennsylvania's counties or specifically Bucks and Montgomery?
We focused on Bucks and Montgomery County, as those are in our coverage areas, but certainly the Supreme Court case that was handed down last year involving Luzerne County, it typifies the concern over the lack of resources for public defenders.
And review for listeners, what are the major findings of that case?
The ruling, it involved a 2012 lawsuit by the Luzerne County Public Defender's Office and the Pennsylvania chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union, and they had filed that on behalf of 300 criminal defendants. The defendants in the case alleged chronic county underfunding had overwhelmed the public defender's office and resulted in, and I'm quoting from the Supreme Court ruling now, sub-constitutional representation. I believe, as I recall reading about this case, the public defender, who now is no longer the chief public defender, but who brought this case, had stopped taking certain cases that qualified for a public defender because he simply did not have enough staff to handle the cases and enough resources to properly litigate the cases.
What is the income threshold to qualify for representation?
Because this is set by the individual counties, it varies across the state. In Montgomery County, the income threshold is 150% of poverty, and that works out to a little bit under $350 a week. In Bucks County, the maximum is $285 a week. They use a variation on 125% of poverty. However, that threshold has not changed since 2015.
Your article cites Dean Beer, Montgomery County's chief public defender, who succinctly says it doesn't get you votes to fund indigent criminal defense. And in that context, describe the effort of Senator Stuart Greenleaf.
Well, Senator Greenleaf, he has for many years proposed a bill that is right now in the form of Senate Bill 61 that would create and fund a state center to oversee the management of indigent civil defense services and create statewide standards. This is something he has proposed going back as far as the 2013-14 legislative session.
Is it your sense that there's more appetite to consider it this time around than there was a few years back?
Senator Greenleaf has told me that for as little as a $1 million appropriation, it would spare the counties from being sued under the Luzerne County decision for inequity. So with the Supreme Court ruling from last year, he might have a little more leverage to bring before the Senate to push this bill.
Joe, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave.
Joe Chevalier, reporter for the Bucks County Courier-Times. Her article, What Price Justice? Difficulties of Facing Criminal Charges Without a Lawyer. For more than 30 years, urbanist Richard Florida has been writing about how to make cities better. In his new book entitled The New Urban Crisis, Florida argues that cities should no longer rely on federal government support to reinvent themselves. Keystone Crossroads reporter Annette John Hall recently caught up with Florida after his talk at the Prince Theater in Philadelphia, where they talked about the fate of cities in the time of President Donald Trump.
There are pillars of success in this state, the Philadelphia area, now Pittsburgh, which is the comeback story of the United States with self-driving cars and all of that, Carnegie Mellon, where I taught. But we're going to have to create a way to get over not just income inequality. What my new book, The New Urban Crisis, is about is geographic or spatial inequality. The small areas of winners that have knowledge institutions, that have great universities, that are attracting investment and talent, and the much bigger areas of losers. And, you know, that's part of the backlash which created Trump and this rise of populism and the anger and the anxiety in our country. So we have to develop strategies to build up, and we have to do it locally, to strengthen their economies, tell them how to build their economies, but we have to do it in a way that's inclusive.
What would that look like? What would that look like in, you know, cities like, not just Philadelphia, because Philadelphia does have the structure for that to be accomplished, but what would that look like in cities like Scranton and cities like Harrisburg?
Boy, Scranton has a spectacular location. It's close to Philadelphia and it's close to New York. Better transit, higher speed rail, and you could even imagine, you know, a higher speed rail link. I've dreamed of it for years. That would link Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, Philadelphia, and New York. What that does is it connects these places to areas of opportunity.
When you talk about teaching people how to build their own economy, you said something in your talk that was really interesting to me, and that was creating this whole idea of mayor's colleges.
I want to launch a mayor's school at the University of Toronto, and Mike Bloomberg has funded a similar effort at Harvard's Kennedy School, and I think we need more of them. And when I say mayor's school, it's not just a school for mayors. You know, there's a medical school for doctors. There's a business school for business executives. There's all sorts of programs for lawyers, for doctors, for engineers to learn. But for city builders, don't get me wrong, there's good urban planning graduate schools, but we don't have the kind of big-scale efforts in educating mayors and urban leaders.
You talked about having to rewrite your book after President Trump was elected. How will this new administration impact cities in your mind, and what can cities do to handle it?
I think that the sad thing that's happened is this populist backlash, the anger, the divide. I talked about how we have to heal that by working locally. Even though most Americans don't like the federal government, and that goes for Democrats and Republicans, red and blue, most people are quite prideful and quite proud and loyal to their local leadership and care deeply about their communities, urban, suburban, rural, ex-urban. So I think we can do. I think we could actually build a bipartisan coalition of mayors, city builders, urban leaders, and national politicians to accomplish that.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's great being with you, and it's great being back in the great city of Philadelphia.
That was Richard Florida talking to Keystone Crossroads reporter Annette John Hall. His new book is called The New Urban Crisis. Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY is the lead station. Old bits of cardboard and scraps of discarded paper turn into tiny sculptures in a local woman's hands. Courtney Harris-Bond reports.
Some ramshackle buildings, the water cooler, a film projector, the Dodge, a boom box.
All these objects fit inside Lydia Ritchie's cozy, messy office because they are not actual size, but are small enough to fit in your palm and made from scraps. In fact, that's what Ritchie calls her work, from scraps, because she constructs the pint-sized, three-dimensional pieces from found items. Everywhere she goes, this Narberth, Pennsylvania woman searches for bits and bobs that catch her eye. In her daily life, Ritchie is a freelance graphic designer. She co-produces a podcast called Rome Schooled. She teaches. But at night, Ritchie digs into her boxes of scraps. Ritchie started making her tiny sculptures years ago with just about anything she could find.
I would call these my valuable possessions. And if you saw them, I mean, it's like a lot of old office supplies. And it's just the color and the texture and the way the metal mixes or something about them. I can't always articulate it. I realized I can cut some of this stuff up and I can maybe honor it in a different way. And so then I realized anything was up for grabs.
Ritchie says objects hold memory, especially the ones you interacted with the most. And she recreates them. Often things that as a 43-year-old remind her of her past. Not exact replicas, but representations of important objects that hold meaning for her. She made a miniature replica of her family's first color TV out of found pieces of cardboard boxes. She glued an old photograph of a house on the front as a screen. This TV meant so much to her that she wanted to reproduce it, right down to the bits of red, blue, and green, indicating that it's a color set.
I remember just my dad sitting it down in the living room, or the family room, we would call it, and we had the brown shag carpeting, and he sat it down, like took it out of the box, and I knew something was up. I mean, I saw that jewel, that red jewel, and the green jewel, and the blue jewel, and I just looked at him, I said, is this color? Is this a color TV? And he said, how did you know? I mean, he thought I was so smart. And so right then, the Flintstones, we watched the Flintstones in color, and it was awesome.
Ritchie has an adoring Facebook following. Cherry Bomb magazine is about to feature her work. Simon & Schuster is publishing two journals featuring some of Ritchie's papercraft objects to inspire others to start creating their own work from scraps. The journals will be available at Target and on Amazon. When I recently went to her house, Ritchie was working on creating a petite replica of a beam scale, the old-fashioned kind still used in some doctor's offices, that also measures the patient's height. Ritchie spent a lot of time searching for just the right piece for the metal bar at the top of the scale.
Like, what's going to make that bar around there? I think it's these things, but I'm not positive. I think if things look too perfect, then it becomes like doll furniture, and that's bad.
Once she located little bits of metal she thought would work, Ritchie started snipping them with her scissors at her paper-strewn table.
Again, like
you probably want, you should watch your eyes. Okay. You didn't realize you should probably wear goggles.
When she finished the sculpture, it looked like an artful interpretation of one of those old-timey scales, and it could fit in someone's palm.
Oh, that looks perfect.
So see how
I love that.
Not too perfect, though, right?
Richie says part of the reason why she has her hand in so many different projects is because she lost her mother early when she was only a freshman in college.
You know, you realize that it may not be, you don't have infinity. You know, so you get your priorities straight and I'm very productive, you know, because of that, I think.
Losing her mother young may have something to do with why Richie spends so much time creating objects from her past, to hold on to these special memories from childhood and bring them back to life. And it helps that her father still lives in the house she grew up in King of Prussia.
He has not thrown a thing away since we were raised in that house. So it's very convenient, you know, you just go around and, I can fill up a bin of inspiration, quote unquote, 10-15 minutes.
Richie says recreating objects from cast-offs is incredibly satisfying and freeing.
Like at the end, you're not like, oh, if I do this, am I going to mess the whole thing up? If you do, you just cover it up with another piece of paper and it's fine.
This is Courtney Harris Bond.
That might be better.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for WHYY's NewsWorks Tonight.